This is the takeaway for Monday, December 11th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us on this Monday. And there are exactly 2 weeks to go before Christmas. And there are about six debates going on in Washington right now, all at once. The Russia investigation, sexual misconduct in Congress and the White House, what to do about Roy Moore. We're going to be talking about that later this hour. There's also the tax plan and also how to avoid a government shutdown at the end of the month. And buried deep within that last one, a possible government shutdown and a spending fight, health insurance for 9 million kids hangs in the balance. The Children's Health Insurance Program expired more than 2 months ago. CHIP, as it's called, is still operating, but Congress has not renewed it yet. And there's a lot of anxiety, not just in states that administer this program for kids from low-income families, but also for their parents. We're spending part of this week looking at the U.S. healthcare system, along with the health desk at WNYC. Who made this American healthcare system? How did we get here? A lot more on that later in the hour, but first, one of the parents who relies on CHIP to care for her kids. Myra Gregory is the mother of three boys, including 11-year-old Rowland, and Rowland has been very sick lately.
I'm a mother of three boys. They are 11, 7, and 8. My oldest son, Rowland, he has stage 4 lung cancer. So currently, I'm a stay-at-home mom.
And tell me a little bit more about Rowland. Can he do things that other kids get to do, go to school and play and get outside?
No. Rowland pretty much stays in the bed all day. He doesn't get to do much. We did go to his school the other day just for a visit so that he could see some of his friends and teachers. But no, my son doesn't get to do anything. He's at home in bed in pain right now.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the drugs and tests, medical personnel, some of the other services that Rowland uses and has access to because of CHIP?
Well, because of CHIP, he's able to get different scans, CT scans, MRIs. My son did 970 hours of chemotherapy, and so CHIP covered that. He also did radiation. He has had 5 operations so far, and let's see, he takes countless of pain medications. He takes oxycodone and hydrocodone, fentanyl. So he takes a lot.
Rowland's a brave kid.
Yes.
And Rowland's two brothers are pretty brave as well. It can't be easy on them. They have CHIP too?
Yes, they do. So we use CHIP for them for, you know, regular doctor visits and immunizations and things like that. But this has definitely been a toll on all of us. But I can say that his brothers have been very helpful.
What's been going on with Rowland's health benefits lately and the tests that he relies on?
In August of this year, his cancer returned. On the first day of school, we got a call, and they told us his cancer returned, and he had like 7 tumors and a whole lot going on. And so since his re-diagnosis with it, we have not had any scans. We haven't had any scans. All that we have had done are x-rays. I know that with his medications, like he takes the hydrocodone daily, and then he has a fentanyl patch. And so I don't know what happens with the insurance companies or the doctors, but so his doctor wrote me a prescription for the hydrocodone, but we had already had the fentanyl patch. So when I went to go get the hydrocodone, the pharmacist wouldn't let me get it. And all she told me was that there was a problem with his insurance. I don't know if this has anything to do with CHIP, but from my understanding, since September, when they didn't renew it, that we are all basically living off of the reserve funding. And so my belief is that if we're all these families in Missouri, if we're all living off of this reserve funding, then I guess it's not enough for all his scans and treatments to be covered because it's only so much money and they have to spread it out between all of us families.
Has the insurance company told you anything about your benefits, about Rowland's care, his tests, or why things are coming up short?
No, I don't want to put no words in anyone's mouth, but I'm guessing that they can only approve something for so long. And then if they don't have anything to say that is getting worse, then I guess they don't see that he still needs it. But they don't have anything to say that it's getting better either, because we can't get these scans done. Like, the scans will let us know where we can go with treatment. It'll let us know if he's getting better or worse, but the insurance company won't let us get the scans. So it's little things like that that we go through.
Myra, I don't know if the lapse in Rowland's tests are connected to the debate going on in Washington over CHIP. I guess we have no idea for sure, but it sounds like the uncertainty of just not knowing when the program's going to be reauthorized has you worried.
Definitely so. The uncertainty, it definitely weighs on me. I definitely am, to say the least, stressed. They said in the state of Missouri that our reserve funding is projected to run out by March. If that's the case, you know, that's going to leave a lot of families, you know, struggling and wondering what to do.
Yeah. Well, Myra, Rowland's a brave kid, and his brothers are brave boys too. And I hope the best for him, and I hope the best for you too. And it means a lot that you would come on and talk to us on the air, given everything that you're going through. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. I appreciate it, because I really feel that Congress needs to act. This program helps over 9 million families. So that's a lot. And I just want to get the word out. So hopefully another family doesn't have to go through the same things that I'm going through.
And we're very happy to have you, Myra Gregory, in St. Louis. Good luck to Rowland, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Joan Alker is executive director of the Center for Children and Families and a research professor at the Georgetown University McCourt School of Public Policy. And Joan says most lawmakers on both sides of the aisle favor CHIP. It's likely to get renewed. But Myra Gregory is an example of how delays mean confusion and added anxiety for the families who use CHIP as a lifeline.
CHIP is either providing care or financing care for about 9 million children in the United States. These children are in families who earn a little bit too much to qualify for the Medicaid program, which is actually the primary source of public coverage for children, but they don't afford enough to be able to afford private insurance. So these are really working families who just simply don't have other options if CHIP is not available.
Joan, CHIP's been around for a long time, and this fall there was a deadline, September 30th, that passed when CHIP wasn't reauthorized. Most people on Capitol Hill think that it will be reauthorized. But in the meantime, has that had an effect on how states are delivering the program? Has anybody run out of money?
Well, I'll tell you, I've been working on CHIP for 20 years since its inception, and we've never seen a situation like this. And I think we're seeing states pay the price here. States are having to prepare contingency plans, in some cases reprogram their IT systems, prepare notices that may be sent to families very soon in some states that says your coverage is in jeopardy. And this is a very unfortunate situation. Last week, we saw the first state, Colorado, actually send out a warning notice to families on the CHIP program to say it's possible that your coverage may be taken away if Congress doesn't act. The state of Utah, which is actually the home of Senator Hatch, who was one of the fathers of CHIP, put up a notice on their website warning families as well. So the concern here is not only are states wasting time and money because of this unfortunate situation, but once families start to hear this coverage may be going away, I fear that we will start losing some kids.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about that, what the effect is of simply a warning to somebody in their mailbox or their inbox that health benefits for their kids could go away.
So that's why, remember, we're talking about, we're at the end of a year here where Congress has been talking all year long about making very big cuts to Medicaid, taking away coverage from families. So to hear about this uncertainty with respect to CHIP on top of that is something I worry very much about, families getting the wrong message.
It sounds like there's the potential for just a lot of confusion here. Look, not just Medicaid and health benefits, the broader debate over the Affordable Care Act. Will they? Won't they? What's Congress going to do? If you're not plugged into this every day because you're busy, you might think you're in trouble here.
Exactly right. I mean, I've been arguing since February that Congress should extend CHIP, get that done. This is a program with bipartisan support, and it could have been, it should have been, an easy win for Congress. They've actually had bipartisan agreement on the policy since September, but they just can't seem to get it over the finish line. That's very frustrating.
So, Joan, regardless of what Congress gets done here, there's confusion for a lot of families, and I think you alluded to that. We heard from one mom, Myra, in Missouri, who says that at the end of September, after the CHIP deadline passed, that her son could no longer get MRIs and scans that he's been receiving, only x-rays, not the more expensive scans. I'm not saying that Congress is causing this. They're probably not. But to Myra and her son, the lapse in benefits for whatever reason is pretty real. What's their recourse?
Well, she needs to immediately, I'm guessing that she's probably in a managed care arrangement. That's how most CHIP programs are run, and I think that's the case in Missouri. So she needs to immediately file an appeal, possibly contact legal services in the state of Missouri, get some help with this. Unfortunately, this is a problem that affects families, but really everybody in the healthcare system, is that when you are sick and you need your coverage the most, that's when you start to get hassled by your insurance company. So it's very important for her to try to get help with her situation, raise it through the appeals process, or, like I say, contacting the state or legal services to get some external help.
And do people have to be skeptical right now if they hear from their insurance carrier under CHIP about benefits falling away or scans that you can't get, yes, that maybe those insurers might try to seek a little cover under the debate in Washington? Oh, it's not us, it's Congress that's throwing things up in the air. Ask them.
Well, certainly if anybody heard that message, I would be very, very skeptical. I think to the extent families are hearing from their states that there are problems in Washington, that they're concerned about the possibility of their coverage going away, like as we've heard from Colorado and Utah, as I mentioned, that is real. That is a real message. And I really feel for states in this situation. You know, they're walking a tightrope here. They don't want to scare families, but they don't have the certainty that Congress is going to come through. And so they want to make sure that families are aware of the situation and know their options, even though they realize very well that families don't have very many other good options besides CHIP. So it's a very difficult situation, and it's ironic because, remember, Congress wanted to block grant Medicaid and hand it over to the states. They're all about state flexibility, and yet this program is a block grant, and here Congress has really left states holding the bag. It's not a good advertisement for block grants.
A dysfunctional Congress can't even pass the CHIP program, which they agree on. That's just how bad things are on Capitol Hill right now, and it's left millions of families wondering when health benefits for their kids are going to finally be approved. Joan Alker with the Georgetown University McCourt School of Public Policy. Thanks, Joan.
Thank you.
Let's go to Southern California now, where wildfires continue to burn through hundreds of thousands of acres. Those fires have driven more than 100,000 Californians from their homes, from Santa Barbara all the way down to San Diego County. The Thomas Fire in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties is now the fifth largest fire in modern California history. We go to Ventura now, a little more than an hour northwest of L.A. with no traffic. Fiorella Calderoni is communications manager at Visit Ventura. Fiorella, thanks for being on The Takeaway.
Hi, Todd. Happy to be here.
I know this is never the kind of attention you wanted for your city and for your county, and I know that a lot of people you know are being affected. Can you bring us up to date on the Thomas Fire in Ventura?
Within the city of Ventura, the flames have subsided. And mostly we're dealing with a little bit of smoke in the air that remains from the Thomas Fire that's burning around us. It's still growing to the north, east, and the west, though the actual city of Ventura is transitioning into recovery. Luckily, most of it was not damaged. A lot of our hillsides were, but in terms of the city, all of our coastline, downtown, the harbor, all of that remains exactly as it did before. So we're trying to transition into recovery down here.
Fiorella, I know you're responsible for promoting Ventura to outsiders, getting visitors in town, but some of the attractions in Ventura were damaged. Can you talk about some of those?
Yeah, unfortunately, again, like most of it, remains undamaged, but the Ventura Botanical Gardens, which were definitely a favorite for locals and for visitors, were directly impacted by the fire. There is a cross up there that is really well liked. The original one was put up in 1782, and it's meant to denote the mission in downtown Ventura, which is one of California's 21 missions. Fortunately, the cross is still standing. The firemen did an amazing job of protecting it, but the rest of the park does appear to be burned.
And Fiorella, how are you doing? How's your family, your friends? How's everybody getting through?
Thank you for asking. We're doing okay. I personally, with my husband, got evacuated on Monday night at the very beginning of the fire. It was a scary situation. The sky was glowing orange. There was ash in the air. You know, we made our way to the evacuation center, and we had no idea what was going to happen, but we feel very lucky. For us, our house is fine. Definitely a scary time, but we feel fortunate. And in terms of the Visit Ventura family, we were touched by the fire, of course, like everybody else. And quite a few people that we know or work with have lost their homes. And so we're trying to be extremely sensitive to that and making sure that we're there for people however we can be.
Sorry to hear that some of your friends and coworkers have suffered damage here. Happy to hear, Fiorella, that you and your husband got through without your home being damaged. Thank you so much for joining us. What's next in your town as people rebuild and pull together here?
Well, you know, some businesses opened back up on Saturday in the downtown area. Most businesses were open again by yesterday. We're hosting a town hall for our businesses today. We're coming together, coming up with ideas to make sure that everybody knows that Ventura is all right for the most part. You know, we know the fire is ongoing. We know our neighbors may need our help. So keeping one eye on the news as we try to move forward.
Fiorella Calderoni says you can still visit Ventura. That's her job in Ventura, California. And Fiorella, thanks for joining us. And I'm glad that people can still visit your town.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me, Todd.
Well, that's the scene in Ventura, California, about 70 miles northwest of Los Angeles. Let's now go down to San Diego, where the Lilac Fire is burning, fueled still by those heavy Santa Ana winds. I want to bring in John Choi. John is a paramedic at North County Fire Protection District in San Diego County. He's currently a public information officer for this Lilac Fire. John, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
Under difficult circumstances, I know, John. Where do things now stand in your county in San Diego?
So currently, this fire, the Lilac Fire, we have it holding at 4,100 acres, and it's 75% contained. It originally started on the I-15 southbound, just south of the 76, and we're working on our day four of this fire. It started off as a 2 to 3 acre fire, and the growth was explosive because of those winds that you mentioned earlier. We have the Santa Ana winds that came in. We were registering wind speeds about 35 miles per hour. That fire grew from those 2 to 3 acres in about 2 hours to 500 acres. By 6 p.m., we had it at 3,000 acres. And by that evening, in the same operational period, we were up to 4,100 acres.
John, the spread that you're describing from 2 acres to 4,100 in a matter of hours is just mind-blowing. What are the state of homes in your area and the overall damage assessment right now?
Sure. The structures destroyed right now is 151. And structures damaged is 56 at this time. We still have San Diego County fire organizations and CAL FIRE going out and checking the damage of our area through our damage assessment teams. So that number is going to go up.
Look, John, I know your job is to talk about this fire and getting that fire contained, but what are people around town saying about just the likelihood of these fires becoming more common, burning hotter, and fire season burning longer? Because I know more and more over the last couple of weeks, people in California are really thinking about that.
This is a norm for us, unfortunately. We even had a period of really good rain. Unfortunately, all that did was increase our grass crop, and then that all dried up. And so now we have this continuity of fuel to carry the fire. And so we're no strangers to wildfires here. And so what people are doing more is they're living with that reality, and they're really getting that defensible space put around their home. You know, the CAL FIRE recommends us to have that 100 feet of perimeter control around your own home. we should really be your plan B. Your plan A needs to be preparation on your own self to make sure your house are ready when a fire happens, because it's not a matter of if, it's when. And so I think that reality has caused a lot of people to look at their own landscape and say, okay, I need to change some things to make my house more prepared for wildfires. And that's the reality of living in Southern California. We have some of the most gorgeous, consistent weather, but that also equals high fire danger.
Wildfire in Southern California, not a matter of if, a matter of when. John Choi, public information officer and paramedic in the North County Fire Protection District in San Diego. John, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome.
By this time tomorrow, voters in Alabama will be heading to the polls to decide whether Republican Roy Moore should be a United States Senator. Roy Moore stands accused of sexual misconduct by at least 9 women, including one who says that he assaulted her when she was a 14-year-old girl. The President of the United States has weighed in on this race.
We need Roy to help us with the Republican Senate. We will win and we will make America great again.
Paid for by Judge Roy Moore for U.S. Senate.
That's a telephone robocall you heard there, hosted by Donald Trump, the President of the United States, beamed into Alabama, urging voters to get out for Roy Moore. Democrat Doug Jones still faces tough odds in conservative Alabama, but this is the most closely watched Senate special election in anyone's recent memory. Pat Duggins is news director at Alabama Public Radio. He's been keeping us up to date on every step in this race. Pat, welcome back as always.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Well, you heard President Trump urging people to get out for Roy Moore there. President Trump is popular in Alabama, Pat. There's no question about it. What are the latest polls telling us? Do they tell us much about how this might go?
I think at this stage of the game, Todd, nobody really cares about the polls, because it's like, you know, what a lot of people in the press are saying, okay, if you look back at the Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump election, the polls weren't really all that accurate. Now, if you take a look at Alabama, there's a historical precedent that goes back even earlier than that, because as part of our coverage, we spoke to historians at the University of Alabama who said that if you go back to the 1960s and Governor George Wallace, the racist segregationist governor back then, people would come out of the voting booth and they'd go to the exit pollers and say, oh, I'm not voting for that dirty, rotten racist. I'm voting for the other guy. And then Wallace would wind up winning by a landslide. So There's the concern that people are not being very forthcoming.
Yeah, whether they're willing to support Roy Moore, are they willing to admit it in public? That's a question that I guess we'll know the answer to on Wednesday. Pat, we heard Donald Trump there. There's also the possibility, we're told, of President Obama wading in with a robocall of his own. And the idea there has to be to try to drive up turnout among African-American voters.
Well, actually, Roy Moore helped do that himself, because back in September, when he was actually taking questions from the press, someone from the LA Times asked him, okay, Donald Trump's big slogan is make America great again. And they asked Moore, when was the last time America was great? And Moore thought for a moment and said, well, you know, the Civil War was actually pretty good. And I guess, you know, it depends on whether or not you're wearing the chains as to whether or not that's accurate. But It brought forth just a wave of woe from both the press and the public regarding, you know, the implications of slavery and whether or not he thought that was a good idea.
Pat, Alabama has another Republican senator already. He's called Richard Shelby, and Richard Shelby's been talking about this race, too.
There's a time, we call it a tipping point, and I think so many accusations, so many cuts, so many drip, drip, drip. When it got to the 14-year-old story, that was enough for me. I said, I can't vote for Roy Moore.
Richard Shelby is a Republican. He's been a senator in Alabama for decades, and the name Shelby's a big name in your state. Does that hold any sway with Republicans?
Well, let's put it this way. You've got Richard Shelby, who says that, okay, I put in a write-in candidate. He didn't say which one, but he put in a write-in candidate. Then you've got the other write-in candidate, Lee Busby, out of Tuscaloosa, whose also his name is on the ballot. So everybody is just, you know, confused as to whether or not what kind of Ralph Nader effect that's going to have on the election, because if you remember Ralph Nader, when, you know, he ran alongside Al Gore and George W. Bush, it was already a tight race, and there was some concern, oh my gosh, how many votes from one side or the other did Ralph Nader, you know, siphon away? Lee Busby, there's concern he may take votes away from Doug Jones. He may take votes away from Roy Moore. There may be other write-in candidates for Republicans who just simply can't vote for Roy Moore, but they couldn't possibly bring themselves to vote for a Democrat. So again, until the numbers come in, we're simply not going to know.
One day to go before this closely watched Senate special in Alabama. Pat Duggins, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We go to the Democratic Republic of Congo now, where more than a dozen United Nations peacekeepers and five Congolese soldiers were killed and more than 50 people were wounded in an attack on a UN base in eastern Congo over the weekend by an extremist group called the ADF. The UN Secretary General is calling this attack the worst in the organization's recent history. Africa Bureau Chief for the Washington Post, Kevin Seif, has been reporting on the attack, and he joined us from Nairobi in Kenya.
The UN has been targeted for years now in this part of Congo, but never in an attack this big. So I think this has really prompted a moment of reckoning for the UN and especially for the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. And they're now sending people from New York to Congo to figure out what went wrong, to figure out if they can prevent another attack like this from happening.
Tell us a little bit more about the ADF and who they are.
The ADF has been operating since the mid-90s along the Uganda border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. But there are still a lot of questions about who they are, what they want. There are some, mostly Ugandan authorities, who would tell you that they're an Islamic extremist organization, that they're jihadists, that they have a religious agenda. There are others, I think, analysts who've been studying Congo for some time, who would say, actually, they're more interested in controlling ground, being able to continue illicit trafficking, mostly the trafficking of timber, in this sort of remote part of Uganda and Congo. We're not talking about Boko Haram. We're not talking about Al-Shabaab. This is a relatively small militant group. But the ADF is one of many groups, and it's one of many groups that has utterly destabilized this part of Congo. And so while they are and have been targeting the UN, I think more than most of the other groups, it's not to say that they are sort of the biggest or the only threat in the region.
Well, talk about some of those other threats. What's the backdrop in Congo? What's been going on there for the last 5 or 10 years that has led to the rise of all of these armed groups and a UN presence there?
It's a combination of a few things. One is the sort of total lack of central governance or legitimate local governance, for that matter, in eastern Congo. So the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo is still Joseph Kabila. There are big questions about how much longer he'll stay in power. According to the constitution, he was supposed to be out already. So that's what's happening in the capital. And then that then has had an effect on what's happening across the rest of the country, where you have parts of eastern Congo where this incident happened last week, where a region that's incredibly rich in natural resources, but without a legitimate and without an effective government. So in that power vacuum, you've got many, many armed groups and a somewhat dysfunctional military taking advantage of those spoils. That is, in some cases, as bad as these militant groups when it comes to trafficking, when it comes to killing civilians. Mostly the people who are paying the price in this region are civilians. I mean, no one knows exactly how many civilians have been killed in eastern Congo, but the estimates are huge. I mean, we're talking about probably thousands of people. And then, of course, you have the biggest UN peacekeeping operation in the world. And a lot of people, including officials in the United States, are asking, well, after so many years of a UN presence in Congo, why are we seeing an uptick in violence?
Well, why would a group like the ADF turn its guns on the United Nations peacekeepers at their base instead of on other armed groups? What's the logic there?
Basically, what's unique about the UN mission in Congo is that a few years ago, they got a mandate to conduct offensive operations against militants. And this was really the first time in the history of the UN where they had an explicit mandate to do this. So suddenly in Congo, one of the armed actors was the United Nations. And of course, on one hand, it did help in some cases to pacify some of the major armed groups. I mean, there were successes. But of course, because they're targeting the militant groups, they themselves have become targets. On one hand, they're trying to keep the peace, you know, they're trying to sort of make inroads here when it comes to pacifying these armed groups. On the other hand, it's hard to do that when a huge amount of your resources are devoted to protecting your troops because they are so frequently targeted.
Kevin Seif, thanks for joining us.
Sure, anytime.
Kevin Seif joins us from Nairobi, Kenya. He's Africa Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway today. And here's a question a lot of Americans are asking themselves. What should our American health system look like? American voters and their politicians have been struggling with that one for decades. Remember this?
oppose Obamacare.
To repeal Obamacare.
Obamacare was off the charts.
Repeal whatever is left of Obamacare.
Repeal every single word of Obamacare.
Well, during the Obama administration, congressional Republicans voted dozens of times to repeal Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. At the time, it was a political stunt, sure. But then, in the 2016 presidential election, things got real.
The Affordable Care Act is here to stay.
My first day in office, I'm going to ask Congress to put a bill on my desk getting rid of this disastrous law.
Well, nearly a year into the Trump administration, the ACA still remains, but there are big problems in America's patchwork healthcare system. Mary Harris is host and managing editor for WNYC's Health Desk. She's been talking to people around the country about their concerns, and a big one is cost.
When you think about the marketplaces imploding, you think about a place like Iowa, because what's happening there, they're down to one insurer this year. That insurer says they are raising rates over 50%. It's a really big deal, and that's where we found this guy, Mark Seaton. He's become really outspoken about healthcare over the last 5 years. He's been buying his own insurance. He works for himself, and so he's been doing that for a while, and he's been noticing the rates on his insurance start to soar, and it got especially bad after Obamacare. Eventually, his insurance cost more than his mortgage because he doesn't qualify for tax credits. He makes a little bit too much. So he started testifying at insurance rate hearings. He called his congresspeople. He actually still does this.
Mostly, I just get form letters back. Thank you for your interest. We're always working to improve healthcare for Iowans, blah, blah, blah.
Do you feel like they're listening?
No, I don't.
Okay, so the last time he went to a rate hearing, which was a couple years ago, it was just before the 2016 election. And the reason I called him is because he ended it with this little speech where he was like, we're going to vote on this issue. There's an election going on right now. And it was like a warning shot.
He said, we're going to vote on this issue. We're going to vote Trump?
Yeah, he is a Trump voter.
So, but then the question is why, Mary? I mean, healthcare costs were going up every year before Obamacare.
Yeah, I mean, he really saw this as a desperation vote. Like, he just wanted something to change. He felt like Hillary Clinton wasn't going to change it enough. And so I asked him, do you regret your vote today?
I have absolutely no reservation for the way I cast my vote.
He really just felt like no one was paying attention to the issue he was raising, and at least Trump was going to get in there and mix things up.
But he sent Trump to Washington, I guess, to mix things up, but then Mark watched with everybody else while attempt after attempt to repeal the Affordable Care Act failed.
Yeah, and he's really frustrated with that.
So, Mary, despite his public advocacy and his political action here, Mark still needs health insurance, right? What's he going to do?
I asked him what he was going to do for open enrollment, and he said, well, actually, I'm not insured right now. I decided last year, I looked at my expenses. I realized I was spending so much on healthcare, more than I spend on my house. And I just decided to go without.
Going without insurance is a risk for the whole family.
Yeah, absolutely. But he literally has a spreadsheet where he's tracking all of the expenses. He's been doing this for a while. And he can see he's spending much less now than he did last year.
So those are the risks and benefits for Mark Seaton in Iowa. He's a Trump voter, fed up with the Affordable Care Act, Mary. You've been following some other people, too.
Yeah, so I started following Katie McFarland after seeing her at a town hall back in February. It was with Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. He was there, he was talking to people, and it was really, really rowdy. She got up.
Will you commit to replacements in the same way that you committed to the repeal?
And it was this moment where the crowd just erupted. Katie is in a wheelchair now. She has this rare genetic condition called Ehlers-Danlos. It's a painful disease of the connective tissue. She can't eat. She uses a feeding tube. And after this town hall, her mission really became doing everything she could to make sure the ACA wasn't repealed.
Well, what did she do?
She's been to Washington 7 times for hearings. She actually just went last week to protest the tax bill. She's gotten arrested a few times for protesting on Capitol Hill. She spent the night handcuffed in an emergency room because she's obviously medically fragile. So she's really made this her mission.
I mean, this seems in some ways, Mary, almost like the exact opposite of Mark Seaton. Two people who need insurance, two people who are taking political action are really, really concerned about it. But have taken almost opposite approaches here.
Yeah, but I was really interested in where they intersect, because both of them are worried about costs. Just like Mark in Iowa, Katie can't find a plan that works for her on the Arkansas exchange. She's still relying on COBRA from her father, who passed away. She also uses Medicare. She's a student. She has trouble making ends meet.
Basically, I get by with the help of my friends. It's a sad state of affairs, but I can't really work. I try. I do photography and I try and do freelance stuff, but with the low level of functioning I have, it's a matter of begging for money online and hoping that I don't get evicted before I can raise enough money for the next month of rent.
For both of these guys, it comes down to costs. And when she looks at this tax bill in Washington, she gets really scared.
Cuts to Medicare mean that my home health supplies, my IV fluids that I depend on not to be fainting five times a day, that the feeding tube formula I literally depend on not to starve to death, that there won't be money in Medicare to pay for that, or that cuts to Social Security might mean that my benefits get cut and I will become homeless even if I find a cheaper place to live.
No, those are possible future cuts. But Mary, there's a more immediate concern. I mean, this tax bill repeals the individual mandate, and all the analysts say that's another 10% hike in premiums.
Yeah. And so for both of these people, that's not good news. It makes them anxious, and they really are feeling all of this anxiety going into the new year, just waiting for the next shoe to drop.
So, Mary, you've got Katie, you've got Mark sort of at two ends of political action on healthcare in America. They both agree on costs. You've made that clear. Anything else?
Well, here's the funny thing. So I asked them both to talk a little bit about how they felt about healthcare and use language to describe how they thought about the system. And they both used the exact same language. They both said it was broken. And it got me thinking, like, how did it get this way? How did we get to a system where two people at the opposite sides of the spectrum can totally disagree in one way, totally agree in another, and we just can't fix it? So I wanted to take a closer look at all the ways that we built this system. That's what we're going to do all week long. We're going to look at these moments in time when we tried to fix the healthcare system, what worked and what didn't.
Well, it's going to be a journey back in time with American healthcare and all across the country with you, Mary Harris. We're going to take that trip with you this week. Looking forward to it.
Thanks so much.
Mary Harris is host and managing editor for WNYC's Health Desk. Our special series is called Your Healthcare, What Happened? Tomorrow, we're going to explore how health insurance got locked into your job, and you can keep up with all of our coverage at thetakeaway.org/healthcare. Tens of thousands of American students lost out when fraudulent for-profit colleges failed to deliver on their promises or went under altogether. The Obama administration moved to try to help defrauded students if they were getting federal tuition loans. And ever since, several Democratic senators have been criticizing the Trump administration for freezing that help. You'll also remember that President Trump agreed to pay $25 million in settlements after being sued for running his own questionable for-profit real estate school, Trump University. And you've had experience with these schools.
Hi, this is Andrew Conkling in Kalamazoo, Michigan. I attended a few semesters at University of Phoenix, and I had a bad experience there. I paid off those loans, but it really set me back from paying off my larger loans from previous years.
Well, today we're zeroing in on those for-profit colleges as part of our new credentials series in partnership with the Joyce Foundation. Eileen Connor is the director of litigation with Harvard's Project on Predatory Student Lending, and she says it's always been difficult for borrowers to get relief, but something changed with the inauguration of President Trump.
Since January 20th, the administration has completely stopped processing these claims for relief from borrowers who were cheated and defrauded by schools like Corinthian and ITT Tech. It's delayed the implementation of the Borrower Defense Regulation that was put in place under the last administration. It's also taking steps to gut rules that really crack down on predatory actors in the federal student loan program. We don't have perfect numbers on this, but what we do know is that there are close to 100,000 current claims pending that are just languishing before the department. I think the numbers of people out there who have the legal right to have their federal student loans canceled is much, much higher.
And what exactly has changed since January 20th?
Where there are federal student aid dollars, there will be predatory actors. I think what we see, though, over time is this cycle of abuse. And they'll really take advantage of people like single mothers, first in their family to go to college, immigrants, veterans, and they'll leave them worse off than they found them, and they'll do it for profit. And it's something that has always been a problem, and I don't think any administration has really been great on protecting the public and students from these actors.
So if your long view here shows that this is kind of a revolving cycle of fraud and predation that goes back to the 1950s, frankly, let's talk about going forward. There are several high-profile cases. You mentioned Corinthian, ITT, that have gone out of business. Other for-profit colleges that have gotten an enormous amount of government scrutiny, and many consumers have just been warned off these places. But what's in the future? Is this a new era in for-profit college regulation, or are they going to morph into something else?
You know, I think that we're going to see a lot of the same patterns repeating themselves. For example, the people who are running these schools that are demonstrated to be predatory are now in the administration and are nominally in charge of policing the program. Robert Eitel is somebody who was the chief compliance officer of Bridgepoint Education, a large for-profit corporation, and he's now a senior advisor in the Department of Education. And just as recently as 2016, his company was being investigated by a whole host of law enforcement agencies, including the Department of Justice, the Department of Education, the CFPB, attorneys general, and he is now a senior advisor in the department. So I think that we can expect that any attempts to police and kick bad actors out of the program really are not going to be taking place.
So if you're a student or a prospective student, if you're looking for training or retraining, you're seeing the advertisements, you're going online, lots of good-looking programs for not much money. What do you have to be on the lookout for?
I think it's really tough, especially for the population that these products are marketed to, that this industry sets its sights on. And I think that's part of the reason that their business model has been successful over time, which is there's such information asymmetry. And in our country, you know, we are all primed to believe that education is a way forward and a way towards progress. And so it's really unfortunate when you get predatory actors like for-profit colleges involved in federal student loan programs. Those loans and those programs that are meant to help people become tools of economic and racial oppression. And it's something that we should all be outraged about. And we should particularly be outraged that the Department of Education and the government is really enabling this fraud. I think the question is, why do these schools have a right to taxpayer money? Why do they have a right to participate in this program? Why isn't anybody stopping them? It's hard to know what more this industry could do to discredit itself, and to see their continued existence and their flourishing is deeply troubling.
So, Eileen, if there were tens of thousands of defrauded students with subsidized student loans who were trying to be made whole in the last few years after these colleges went out of business, many of them, and none of those applications are being processed now, what's the recourse? If somebody can't get an application for relief processed, what can they do?
People are really stuck today. We're certainly trying to do what you traditionally do when you have rights and they're being trampled, we bring lawsuits. So we are suing the Department of Education, we're suing schools, we're suing people trying to collect on these debts. I mean, when you're talking about people being made whole, I think it's really important to talk about the fact that these people will never be made whole. So recently, the department has said that they want to reconsider whether people who went to Corinthian and other schools that are documented frauds, whether they should be getting all of their loans wiped out or only some of their loans. In my view, if the government does what is legally required, all of the loans will be canceled, but that shouldn't be mistaken for an idea that that's full relief in any sense of the word. For example, one of my clients is a young woman. She dropped out of high school when she was 15 and had her daughter. She was desperately trying to make ends meet and went to school to be able to work in the medical profession. She got recruited into Everest Institute in Massachusetts, which is a part of Corinthian Colleges, and she ended up with a tremendous amount of debt. The school was a complete fraud. She really got nothing of value from going there. She's currently working in a minimum wage job. She is in a shelter. She is unable to move out of the shelter because her wages are being garnished by the government to pay this illegitimate debt. Her credit is ruined. She doesn't qualify for a lot of apartments. So I don't know how just wiping out that debt is anything other than giving her partial relief.
So, Eileen, what has Betsy DeVos said about this? What has she said when she's asked about the relief from students who have federal loans who were defrauded in this way?
I think it's pretty clear that Secretary DeVos does not understand the predicament of people like my clients who have been cheated and ripped off. And in fact, we've asked for her to have a meeting with our clients. She's refused. When she does speak on this issue, it's to rooms of Republican donors, and she says things like, students are just looking to be able to raise their hand and get free money. That's deeply offensive. The only people here who are getting free money are these predatory for-profit colleges, and it's time it stopped.
Eileen Connor is Director of Litigation for Harvard's Project on Predatory Student Lending. Eileen, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Well, earlier in the hour, we talked about the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. It's in limbo now because Congress let it officially lapse 2 months ago, and we wanted to know if you've used CHIP for your family.
This is Iris from Woodcliff Lake. My grandchildren rely on it. Their parents have bare bones coverage but can't afford family coverage. Without the Children's Health Insurance Program, they will have to ask for help from us. We are retired, but the kids need to be covered. I'm guessing we aren't the only grandparents that will have to step in, no matter the hardship.
Tell us your story on CHIP or anything else, 8778-MY-TAKE. You can always comment on Facebook. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.